Good evening, this is Sue, VK4ST, and this is the Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Last week, David, VK4TDR, spoke to us about the very basics of antennas. This week, David continues on this theme. Have you ever wondered just how a radio wave actually gets out of an antenna? You send a wave from your transmitter up the feed line to the antenna. We say the antenna radiates that wave into space. How does the antenna do this? Tonight, David explains this when he discusses the mechanism of radiation. There has been a lot of lightning about in southeast Queensland lately. This has led to some anxiety and discussion on air about what can or cannot be done about lightning protection. Tonight, Kev, VK4VKD, delivers an excellent talk on lightning and what can be done to at least minimise the hazard to towers and antennas. There is much misinformation on this topic, so for the real facts, don't miss what Kev has to say. Coming up soon. Are we alone in the universe? Is there anyone else out there? Perhaps the greatest DX project of all time is SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Don't adjust your wireless, just listen to RAT VK4XRF as he talks about radio communication and SETI. Please stand by for this evening's program.
This is the weekly education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.
Tonight, David, VK4TDR, discusses the mechanism of radiation, or, in other words, he answers the question, how do radio signals really leave the antenna?
Good evening. Tonight I'm going to continue on from last week and look at the mechanism of radiation. But before I do so, let's quickly review the main points from last week's session. Firstly, we looked at the question of what is an antenna. Well, an antenna is simply an electrical conductor constructed so as to either radiate electromagnetic energy, receive electromagnetic energy, or both. We also looked at antenna reciprocity, which is simply the property of interchangeability. That is, an antenna will receive with the same efficiency with which it radiates. Finally, we looked at how a dipole antenna is created. We discussed how a quarter-wave section of parallel transmission line, which normally is not an efficient radiating element, can be arranged to become a very efficient antenna. This was accomplished by splitting the quarter-wave section in half and thereby constructing a half-wave antenna. If a voltage is applied to the line, causing a current to flow, the current will be a maximum at the source and a minimum at the open ends. The voltage, however, will be a maximum at the ends and a minimum at the source. The distribution of the magnetic and electric fields before we did the splitting was such that the fields cancelled each other out and therefore the parallel line did not radiate. Remember that the magnetic fields for the two conductors are opposing. This happens because current flows in opposite directions through the two conductors making each side of the line. However, when we split the transmission line to create our dipole antenna, we destroyed the field cancellation. Now, the magnetic field is still the most intense near the source, but the electric field now extends from the positive charges at one end to the negative charges at the other end of the line. There is no longer the cancellation of the magnetic fields as was present in the parallel two-wire line. The magnetic field is called an H field, and the electric field is called an E field. Since the current and voltage which produces these E and H fields are 90 degrees out of phase, the fields will also be 90 degrees out of phase. How energy is radiated from an antenna and propagated into free space is a source of controversy among those people concerned with it. However, of all the theories available, the following theory has a wide acceptance among radio engineers. There are two fundamental fields associated with every antenna, an induction field and a radiation field. The field that is associated with the energy stored in the antenna is the induction field. This field is said to provide no part in the transmission of electromagnetic energy through free space. However, without the presence of the induction field, there would be no energy radiated. To understand the manner in which the induction field is produced, we will imagine a low-frequency generator connected to an antenna, and one cycle of operation will be explained. Initially, let us consider the generator output to be zero, so that no fields exist about the antenna. Now imagine that the generator, which is feeding our dipole antenna, produces a slight potential which makes the left arm of the dipole more positive than the right. Acting as a transmission line, the antenna exhibits both capacitive and inductive properties. With the initial application of a generator potential, the antenna capacitance acts as a short, allowing a large antenna current to flow in the left to right direction. This in turn produces a large magnetic field about the antenna. Since current is a minimum at the ends of the antenna, the corresponding magnetic fields at the ends will also be a minimum. As time passes, charges accumulate at the ends of the antenna, which oppose antenna current and produce an electrostatic field. Eventually, the antenna capacitance becomes fully charged and the current flow stops. Under this condition, the electrostatic field is now a maximum, and the magnetic field is fully collapsed. You can now imagine our dipole antenna having a positive charge at the left-hand end and a negative charge at the right. Thus, we now have an electric field extending from the left-hand side of the antenna to the far right-hand side. As the generator's potential decreases back towards zero, discharging of the antenna potential occurs. During the discharging process, the electrostatic field collapses and the current begins to flow in the opposite direction, that is, from the right-hand side towards the left. With the flow of current, an associated magnetic field is generated. Eventually, the electrostatic field completely collapses, the generator potential reverses, and current is a maximum. As charges accumulate at the ends of the antenna, an electrostatic field is produced and current flow decreases. This causes the magnetic field to begin collapsing, producing more current flow, with a greater accumulated charge and electrostatic field. Eventually, the current will fall to zero and the accumulated charges at the ends will become a maximum. We will then have the situation where the far right-hand side of our dipole will have a net positive charge, and the far left-hand side will have a net negative charge. This now creates an electric field which extends from the far right-hand side of our dipole to the far left-hand side. As the generator potential decreases towards zero, the antenna begins to discharge, and the electrostatic field collapses. When the instantaneous generator potential becomes zero, discharge current is a maximum, and the associated magnetic field is therefore a maximum. Shortly thereafter, the generator potential reverses, and the whole process begins again. The intensities of the magnetic and electrostatic fields in the vicinity of the antenna are 90 degrees out of phase. We have not been discussing radiation from the antenna. We have been looking at the induction or near field around the antenna. No energy is radiated from this near induction field. As an aside, many early radio transmission experiments were not really radio at all, as they relied on the very short-range induction field. Since no energy was radiated from the antenna, all the energy applied to the induction field was returned to the antenna by the collapsing electrostatic and magnetic fields. The intensity of the induction field decreases as the square of the distance from the antenna. Consequently, for all practical purposes, it is considered a local field. In order to understand how radiation from an antenna occurs, it is important to realize that the electrostatic and magnetic fields about an antenna take time to collapse into the antenna when the polarity changes. This process of collapsing into the antenna is precisely how a charged capacitor or inductor returns their energy to the power supply in any circuit. Capacitance and inductance do not dissipate or radiate any energy. Capacitance and inductance just charge from the power supply and then discharge, returning all of their energy back to the circuit. So it is with an antenna. However, this process takes time. Well, what if we were to reduce this time? What if the energy in the magnetic near field about an antenna did not have the time to collapse and return to the antenna? How could we reduce the time available for the electrostatic and magnetic fields to return their energy to the antenna? Well, we could simply increase the frequency. Let's now take a look at how the radiation field is propagated away from the antenna. To make it easier to visualize, we'll just consider the electric fields. Remember that an electric field about a dipole antenna is fully extended when the charges at the ends of the dipole are at a maximum. Now, when the generator voltage begins to fall back to zero, the energy in the electric field begins to collapse back into the antenna. But remember, we have increased the frequency such that the electric lines do not have time to collapse and return their energy to the antenna. The generator's frequency is too fast. When the generator voltage is zero and about to reverse and produce new electric lines of force with the opposite direction, guess what happens to the electric field? Well, they are simply left stranded outside the antenna. There was insufficient time before the generator reversed polarity for the energy contained in the electric fields to return to the antenna. The electric lines of force, or flux lines, snap off the antenna and make continuous loops. Think about how a soap bubble snaps off a bubble pipe and forms a continuous sphere on the pipe. In a manner, the electric lines snap off the antenna and form continuous loops outside the antenna. Of course, the antenna is now generating new electric lines of force with the opposite direction. The electric and magnetic fields stranded outside the antenna are repelled away from the antenna by the new fields being created at light velocity. It's similar in a way to how successive bubbles from a bubble pipe drive the existing bubbles away. Since successive electric fields are generated with polarity opposite that of the preceding electric field, an oscillating electric field is produced along the direction of propagation. When an electric field oscillates, a magnetic field is produced, having an intensity which varies with that of the electric field. The variations in electric field intensity is equivalent to the current even though it is not associated with a charge. This is called displacement current and produces a magnetic field in the same manner as conduction current. The variations in magnetic field intensity in turn produce an electric field. The two varying fields sustain each other, thereby resulting in electromagnetic wave propagation. Thus, the varying magnetic field in turn produces a varying electric field, and the varying electric field in turn, through its associated displacement current, sustains the varying magnetic field. Each field supports the other, and neither can be propagated by itself without setting up the other. Well, that's all I have for you this week. I hope that's given you a reasonable insight into the mechanism of radiation. Good evening.
Please stand by for Kevin, VK4VKD, who is speaking to us tonight about lightning, towers and antennas. Kev tells us what we can do to minimise the lightning hazard.
VK4VKD, and I'm here to give you a little talk on lightning protection equipment. The information I'm going to relate is put out by a company called Polyphaser, and it's an overview on lightning protection. The severity of a lightning strike is a statistically predictable event. An economically designed protection grounding system should take into account a typical to large strike. The PG system should be maintained on a monthly or at least yearly basis. This should include testing protectors, measuring the ground system, pulling on ground rods, and cleaning, inspecting connectors for corrosion and tightness. It should also involve a re-evaluation of the overall system design and should always be re-evaluated any time new equipment is installed, moved or modified. A lightning strike starts with a local breakdown of the atmosphere called a step leader and steps about 150 feet in 1 microsecond time increments every 50 microseconds. During each of the 49 microsecond dormant stages, an imaginary hemisphere of 150 foot radius can be used to determine the next jumping distance. Any object which penetrates this hemisphere can be chosen as the point of attachment for the return stroke, or as we call it, the lightning strike. Since this is a hemisphere, the geometry of a horizontal strike to a tower can occur anywhere above the 150 foot point over average terrain. Side-mounted antennas above this height are extremely vulnerable. This has led to the 150 foot radius rolling ball concept, where an imaginary ball is rolled along the ground in all directions. Each touch point of the ball with any ground-mounted object is subject to an attachment point, or a hit, as we call it, a lightning strike. Coaxial grounding kits should be installed every 75 feet above the 150 foot point. Install additional kits below the 150 foot point at the middle bottom and prior to the building entry bulkhead. Lightning will take the path of least impedance, which is both resistance and inductance. The larger the conductive surface, the lower the inductance. Bends add inductance. A coil is the continuous bending of a wire. Ground wires should be large and run straight for minimum impedance and voltage drop. They also should be separated from all other conductors by 6 to 8 inches and should not be run inside or through a conductor unless they are bonded to it. In conduit, ground wires should be bonded at both the entrance and the exit. When working with a metal wall, bond the ground wires to both sides of the wall. Do not go through the wall. Your tower will be the point of impact, like a pebble in a still pond. The rings will be equipotential waves as they diffuse into the surrounding soil. The ground wires in the soil still have inductance. This inductance, shunted by the soil resistance, sets up a time constant or velocity of propagation, since capacitance is also present. The ripples will propagate faster with larger surface area wire and better conductive soil. The doping of soil with Epsom salts, or MgSO4, magnesium sulfate, can help increase soil conductivity and help retain water. It is not necessary to run interconnecting rings around a tower. Self-supporting towers will equalize the surge current to each leg. The coax leg may have slightly more current. Guide towers should not have rings, even if the rings are to act as a collector for the radials. If each radial is interconnected directly to the tower base or leg, the inductance would be less than having only one or two connections going to a ground ring. Rings further out would be connecting radial ground rods that will have the same potential at the same point in time. Thus, little current will flow as compared to taking the same material and effort and running another radial from the tower base. Guy anchors should be grounded with no dissimilar metals. In poor soil conditions, radials can be used together with ground rods to ground the anchor points. A ground system can be obtained in many ways, but the most economical is with radials and ground rods. Radials of less than 100 foot will disperse the tower base or guy wire energy outward, while the ground rods can help to take it lower into more conductive soil layers. If the surge is not leaked or launched into the soil in the radial sections, the ground rods, if lower soil conductivity can't be found, will develop high electrical fields and can arc in the soil to spread the charge outward. This arcing is less likely in soils with higher conductivity. Arcing can cause a problem. The problem being, of course, is the glassification around the rod, starting at the tip and working outward. This arises from the hot plasma in the electrical surge or current, fusing the silica sand into a glass, which is a good insulator since water is boiled out in the process and can no longer re-penetrate the hardened glass. This is why, as a routine part of maintenance, a tug on the rod which produces easy movement is a possible indication of glassification. In other words, the rod is no longer held firmly in the ground by its own surface area, but it's in a slippery coating of glass and it moves easily. The whole practice of lightning protection is to control the discharge path and not have it randomly disperse in any direction. In normally conductive soil, two rods should be spaced the sum of their lengths apart. One long, deep rod or well casing will not work as effectively as an array of radials and ground rods. Even if the one deep rod measures a low resistance, the inductance is usually much greater. In conductive upper layer soil conditions, saturation can occur, which can cause eddy currents and additional inductance. Unlike the radials, ground rod diameter size will have little effect on impedance unless the rod is very long. It is not always imperative to reach the water table, since this may be too far for the rod to be effective. It may be easier to salt dope with your Epsom salts and the ground around the area where the rod is, or use a chemical ground rod that collects precipitation. It attracts moisture to it. In poor soil conditions, the spacing of ground rods should be closer. Poor ground conductivity will not shunt the radial's inductance. Thus, more ground rods will help by either reaching more conductive soil or arcing to relieve the voltage potential. If not quickly dispersed, the voltage will build up at the tower and attempt to go to another, a lower impedance and normally an unwanted path straight to your radio shack. All radials should be run away from the equipment building. Do not run your radials towards the area where you've got your radio. If it's in your house, make sure that the radials go either straight across your yard or away from the house at the base of the tower. The more radials there are, the more the current is divided. A perimeter ground system or ring around the building will help form an equipotential plane. If this ring is approximately equal in length to each radial, and if 8 radials are used, each will have 1/9 of the total surge energy. This will leave only 1/9 of the strike energy there to affect the equipment building or in the perimeter ground around the building. The perimeter should only have one interconnection to the tower base, and this should be just below the coaxial cable run. For mountain tops where there's no soil conductivity, where you're on very rocky ground and only radials can be used, a wide copper strap, 1.5 to 3 inches wide, should be used to minimise the inductance. I should be talking in millimetres and centimetres, I suppose, in the metric system, but I think we can easily convert the inches over anyway. The rebar in the concrete tower base should be used to augment the grounding system. And this is where I find a lot of people come to me, particularly in my profession of building towers, and they ask me how they should earth their tower. And I always stress very strongly that the rebar cage that holds the hold-down bolts that's cast into the concrete should have an unlimited, or as much as possible, grounding steel driven out into the walls, into the earth, around the hole where the concrete's going to be poured. And this should be electrically connected as solidly as possible, preferably welded to the rebar cage that holds the hold-down bolts. There's no substitute for dispersing the surge voltage when it strikes. Okay, so concrete, of course, is conductive because of retained moisture and alkalinity. The tower J-bolts or anchor bolts embedded in a conductive concrete tower base will couple strike energy to the concrete. The surface area interface between bolt and concrete will conduct high-level currents during a strike. If the ground system is not adequate, the current density can be high enough to cause arcing at the bolt-concrete interface. Now, this is where you can have a very, very serious problem. If the tower is not earthed out through the base, the huge voltage surge in the bolts can actually cause the concrete base to explode. Now, this has been a bit of a problem with things like concrete yachts at sea. They've suffered a lightning strike and the yachts have completely disintegrated. They just blow to pieces. The ferro-concrete yacht, of course, having a shell of mesh wire, steel mesh wire usually, which is over-rendered with concrete. Okay, when the rebar is interconnected with the bolts, there is additional surface area interface with the concrete, reducing current density. So this is where you come to the point of adding as much steel in that base as possible and drive it out into the walls. Get it out there so that it's into conductivity and into the soil, and you reduce your problems. By interconnecting the rebar, the current density will be reduced and arcing will be less likely to occur. Now, there's a terrific book on this if you wish to learn more. It's called The Grounds for Lightning and EMP Protection, which is put out by Polyphaser. It is not necessary to route a single copper wire up a large galvanized steel tower. The difference in resistance between copper and galvanized steel is lost when compared to the inductive voltage drop, due to surface area or skin effect. Placing a lightning rod at the tower top and using the copper cable and tying it to the ground is ineffective. And I think a lot of you will probably at some stage see where people have put lightning rods or lightning forks at the top of towers and they run a big big copper trace down the side of the tower to reduce the impact or reduce the chance of lightning strike. Unfortunately, they're dealing with illusion there. The tower itself is the best way to carry the strike to ground. Now, the placing of a lightning rod at the tower top and the using of the copper cable and tying it to the ground is ineffective. The inductive voltage drop of the wire, more than 100 kilovolts, will cause it to jump or arc across to the tower, unless it is at least 24 inches from the tower, and this sort of makes this type of system a little bit more impractical. Having standoffs 2 foot long to carry a copper strap down to the ground. In fact, the use of a bare copper cable can cause a corrosion problem in the tower, and it should not be used unless the copper is covered. Copper should never come into contact with galvanized steel. Now, tinned copper should never be used in the ground together with copper ground rods. The tinning on the copper wire will very, very quickly corrode away and leach off into the soil. Increasing the distance between the tower and the coaxial cable entry provides additional propagation time for the tower ground to absorb the strike energy. This is, having a longer coaxial run from your tower base or where the grounding system of the tower is across to your radio station gives the more chance for the lightning strike to dissipate into the ground rather than travelling along the coax. At the building entry bulkhead panel, coax protectors should be used in addition to another set of coax grounding kits. This bulkhead panel should have ground connectors connecting it to the perimeter ground with the same circumferences as the combined circumferences of the coaxial cables. Tower lightning protectors should also be included and grounded at this same point. In a PG system design, one should also think of system noise reduction and EMI RFI shielding. This can be accomplished with a single point grounding system. Sometimes the use of a single ground bus, called the principal ground window or PGW, can act as your single point. All of your equipment chassis should be grounded to this bus. It should be a large surface area connection to the ground system, such as the brand name polyphaser bulkhead panel, which is quite a substantial ground bus, believe me. Typically, the plasma column of the lightning strike or the return stroke can have a voltage rise time of 20 to 50 nanoseconds. If it hits a tower, the tower will handle the majority of the current pulse to ground. The tower will also radiate the RF energy of the strike. The near field, high magnetic or H field, will penetrate equipment interconnecting wires and induce surge current. A Faraday cage can reduce this energy. A halo ground system with multiple down connectors to the outside perimeter ground loop can act as a quasi Faraday cage and give some low frequency shielding. Properly bonded metal building panels can act as a more effective cage. Doubled wall screen rooms offer the greatest isolation. But of course here we're talking about very, very strictly built commercial radio stations, far and away removed from what the average amateur radio station would have to offer protection and filtering or screening. Tower flasher lines, both strobe and conventional, should have protectors to prevent surge entry into the building on the power lines, as well as nuisance damage to PC strobe boards. Again, that's something that probably doesn't bother us a great deal. But in essence, I suppose, what I've already spoken about is probably mostly relevant to what we'd see in the amateur radio station. The short of it all is there's no substitute for grounding your equipment. The better the grounding system, the better the chance of dispersing that initial strike, and the more of the lightning strike you can disperse into the ground, the less of it is going to come into your shack. Okay, that's about all from me, and we'll pass it back to the net controller or the education officer. Thank you very much for having me along.
What is it about madness and science? Perhaps science makes one mad. Maybe it just helps in science to be mad. Tonight, the University of Houston looks at the mad scientist.
This is the Engines of Our Ingenuity, made possible by the University of Houston and the friends of KUHF.
Today, we wonder about mad scientists. The University of Houston's College of Engineering presents this series about the machines that make our civilization run and the people whose ingenuity created them. The laboratory is down the stairs, out of the light. It's equipped with bubbling glassware and arcane electromechanical machines. The scientist himself is lonely, naive, and egomaniacal. He tells the Foundation about his humanitarian aims, while something in his animal nature drives him to darker things. The picture of the mad scientist is too strong. We can't shrug it off as just another piece of popular fiction. It's the image of science and technology we revert to when we let down our guard. We have to ask where it comes from and what it means. Physicist Spencer Wert thinks it comes out of the Faust story, and I think that makes a lot of sense. The real Faust was a shadowy figure in the early 16th century, a kind of self-styled magician and hellraiser. One place he shows up is in the records of the city of Ingolstadt, the same town Mary Shelley used as the home of Victor Frankenstein. Storytellers took up the legend of this character and recast him in the language of the Protestant Reformation. The Faust we know, the Faust who sold his soul for knowledge, was given his present form in 1607, in Christopher Marlowe's book, The Tragical History of Dr. Faustus. That's about the same time that modern science was taking shape as the companion of technology. 200 years later, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein took Faust a step further. Knowledge alone wasn't enough for Frankenstein. He had to create life as well as understand it. The evil force that served Faust was alchemy. Frankenstein wrote electrochemistry on his trip to hell. Later in the 19th century, Faustian mad scientists added hypnotism and then the mysterious new forces of radiation, X-rays and radium. The early 20th century gave us Faustian technologists, Captain Nemo, and the huge, soul-eating, mechanical city of Metropolis. And, of course, today's mad scientist is wed to his computer. Each new scientific or technological discovery calls forth new fears, fears that we won't be able to control it. Each new discovery brings out Faust or Frankenstein or the mad scientist in some new incarnation. Robert Louis Stevenson added a new twist. The monster, Mr. Hyde, emerged from his gentle Dr. Jekyll when Jekyll lost control of his knowledge. Jekyll and Hyde touched something about our nature that we all understood instinctively. The Faustian mad scientist is a fictional shorthand for describing our potential lack of control, not so much of our science-based technology as of ourselves. He's a sort of warning light for all of us to think about. I'm John Leanhart at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
Please don't adjust your set. Stand by for RAP VK4XRF as he discusses the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
You've probably heard of SETI, S-E-T-I. It stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. SETI has a history that spans two decades, and it's a very interesting history. To discuss that, I've downloaded some information from their website, and I will read to you a transcript written by a Thomas R. McDonough. It best describes the two decades of SETI and its history. In 1981, disaster struck. NASA had been going full steam, building the world's largest radio to search for alien civilizations. But one man objected. and because that man was a powerful US senator, he was able to kill their budget. Senator Proxmire thought NASA was just wasting the taxpayers' money in the foolish hunt for non-existent little green men, so he added an amendment to the US budget that cut off the money for NASA's project. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, called SETI, had become increasingly respectable. Starting with the first modern call for SETI in a scientific paper by Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison in 1959, and the first modern radio telescope search by Frank Drake the next year, a handful of astronomers had been looking for signals, but most of the time there was only enough money for brief searches, mostly with existing equipment. Finally, just when SETI was starting to get the NASA treatment, a dedicated long-term project using powerful, specially designed computerized equipment, they were ordered to cancel the project. However, one new factor had arisen recently that was beyond the Senator's control. The Planetary Society had just been created with the goal of supporting both space exploration and SETI. I had become the Society's SETI coordinator, and one of my duties was to maintain contact with NASA's SETI program. And so it was that I found myself in Northern California at my first major meeting with the NASA SETI scientists and other advisors. It was held in a room with a long, six-sided table that reminded me of a coffin, which fitted our mood perfectly. The one bright note was provided by a young Harvard professor, Paul Horowitz, who had been working with the NASA scientists. He described his plan to build a SETI system so small that it would be portable, able to be carried to existing radio telescopes. He called it Suitcase SETI. We agreed to support it, and within a year, the Planetary Society's first SETI project was scanning the heavens. In 1982, an event in Hollywood had an unexpected impact on the world of SETI. Steven Spielberg released the movie E.T., The Extraterrestrial, and it had become one of the most popular films in history. Carl Sagan and his wife, Anne Druyan, had met Spielberg several times for informal dinners and long conversations. One afternoon at a hotel in Southern California, Sagan and Druyan were awaiting a visit from Spielberg to show him their newborn daughter, Alexandra. They were shaking their heads over the state of NASA's SETI program. He mentioned his desire for a major SETI project far beyond what we were already doing at Harvard. When Spielberg arrived, the conversation naturally turned to SETI. Suddenly, Druyan looked at Spielberg and blurted out that he could give Columbus his three ships. She asked Sagan what it would cost. He had actually told her the answer the night before, and she knew that on the scale of Hollywood and the Defense Department, it would not seem out of reach to the director. Sagan said we could mount a credible program for $100,000. Spielberg immediately agreed. Thus was born Project META, Mega Channel Extraterrestrial Assay. Horowitz built a receiver covering an unprecedented 8 million radio channels. In 1985, Spielberg personally threw the switch that turned on the new system. SETI took another major step forward. And so, the Planetary Society served as the catalyst that allowed science fiction to react with science fact. Over the years, Spielberg's connection with the Society has remained strong, and he is now a member of our board of directors. SETI touches upon many sciences, leading us to support a fascinating array of projects during our first two decades. We helped arrange for American scientists to travel to the USSR when American government funding was unavailable. We have contributed to the study of dolphin communication, the search for planets around other stars, radio observations in Australia and Ohio, a SETI conference in Toronto, and a conference on interstellar flight in New York. Project META was replaced by an even more powerful system, Horowitz's Project Beta, with a quarter of a billion channels. Most SETI has been conducted in the Northern Hemisphere, but the southern half of the universe is rich with potential sites for other civilizations. So we have been delighted to work with the Argentine Institute of Radio Astronomy to help build a SETI observatory there. META 2, the first permanent SETI observatory on the southern half of our planet. One of their scientists, Guillermo Lemachand, now edits our bioastronomy news. This newsletter helps keep the world's SETI community communicating with each other. The most spectacular success we have had in getting the public interested in SETI came about because of an ingenious idea for analysing the huge amounts of data that SETI produces. In 1996, David Gedge and Craig Kasnoff had the idea of using the internet as a supercomputer to process the data. Thousands of computers could handle small pieces of the calculation. Eventually, this came together at the University of California at Berkeley with Project Serendip, the search for extraterrestrial radio emissions from nearby developed intelligent populations. Designed by Stuart Bowyer and Dan Wertheimer, Serendip has been through several versions and was on the verge of extinction when they came to us for funds. We enabled them to survive, and they went on to build the version that is now attached to the world's largest radio telescope, the giant Arecibo dish in Puerto Rico. With support from the Society and other resources, the goal of using the internet to analyze the vast quantities of Serendip's Arecibo data became reality. Under the direction of David P. Anderson, Wertheimer and their team designed the system called SETI at Home that now allows computer users everywhere to participate in SETI. We had hoped that we could get 100,000 people to participate. We got 2 million. There are so many computers now that we can look for subtle signal types that no one has had the computing power to search for previously. If you want to try it out yourself, just go to our website, http://planetary.org. Over the years, there has been a debate within the SETI community about which is better across the galactic vastness, radio or laser communication. Most astronomers had concluded that radio was the easiest and cheapest way to communicate between distant stars, but a few scientists felt that lasers were the way to go, and during the last few years, they have convinced many researchers that there are solutions to the difficult problem of detecting faint light or infrared signals near a bright star. So now scientists are doing both. The Society, together with the SETI Institute, is supporting light-based SETI projects at Harvard and Berkeley. Optical telescopes search for flashes of light or for light whose energy is concentrated into an unnaturally pure color, either of which could be distinguished from the steady, multicolored natural light of a star. The colorful graph of Arecibo SETI data cheerily greets me every time I return to my computer terminal, like a scene in a science fiction movie. So far, we have not discovered any alien signals. This is disappointing, but every scientist involved in such a search knows that it's a tough job. We have to scan the entire sky at a huge range of possible frequency, guessing at the type of signal they might transmit. Nobody knows what the best technique is, or even what frequency aliens might use. It's possible that they use a communication technology we have not yet discovered, but even then, they might use primitive technology like ours to make contact with new civilizations, much as we might use smoke signals to contact a tribe that did not have radio. All we can do is make intelligent guesses and search the sky as thoroughly as possible in as many ways as we can using the most powerful technology we can afford, but the reward, if we are successful, will be to prove for the first time in history that we are not alone. Carl Sagan's introduction to the book Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence expressed eloquently the goal which we are still pursuing. In a very real sense, this search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a search for a cosmic context for mankind, a search for who we are, where we have come from, and what the possibilities are for our future in a universe vaster both in extent and duration than our forefathers had ever dreamed of. The Planetary Society will continue with your support to carry on that vision. So there you have it. I think Thomas summarizes two decades of SETI fairly well there. If you're interested in the SETI at Home project, I intend to make that a topic of perhaps a couple more of our education hours, because it's a fairly long topic. There's a great deal of information explaining how the project works, how the data gets processed by the person's computer when it's screen saving, and what happens to the data and things like that. All very interesting. But tonight, I have a couple of sound samples. One is a sound sample that is the type of data that SETI is listening to, and it sounds just a bit like a hissing sound, but that's probably the kind of thing that they're looking for signals within. So I'll put that in there, and the second sound is the sound of a pulsar, which I thought was a fairly interesting thing. That's a spinning collapsed star, and this particular one is called Pulsar B0329+54. So I'll play the sounds for you now. As you can hear from that sample, there's not a lot of difference in the background noise and the signal, so if they find anything, they've done a pretty good job. So coming up next is the sound of the pulsar. Thank you. That's it from me for tonight. See you again next week.
Thank you very much for that, Raph. I particularly enjoyed the radio noise coming from the pulsar at the end of your segment. I find pulsars to be fascinating. A neutron star is what remains when an ordinary star goes supernova. A neutron star may only be 10 kilometres in diameter, and it has an immense magnetic field because of its density. It may have a density 1.5 times as much as our Sun, and it is rotating rapidly. Radio emissions given off by the neutron star may be focused into the direction of the poles of the star in a conical shape, like very much like a lighthouse. So as the star rotates, the beams of radiation will alternately face towards us and away from us. That's what causes the pulsing sound of the pulsar. Fascinating stuff. Good work, Raph. I hope you've got some more things like that to share with us in the future. To finish off tonight's Education Hour, we've got another segment from the University of Houston. They're talking in this one about the difference between professionals and amateurs. I wonder if you've ever thought about it yourself. What is the difference between professionals and amateurs? The definitions are fairly broad, but fundamentally, an amateur is a person who does something out of passion and love of doing it. Sadly, the word amateur is often associated with the word amateurish, and amateurish has come by many to mean not good, not as good as professional. That's not true. Many of the great scientists, the great discoverers, the great inventors were scientists, discoverers and inventors because of their love and passion for what they were doing. They were driven by love and passion rather than just the pursuit of financial reward. Amateur does not mean less than or not as good as. Please have a listen to this segment from the University of Houston. You are listening to the Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.
Today we talk about amateurs and professionals. Here's a book of Corelli sonatas for violin and continuo. It is an elegant book published in 1785. Its stiff rag paper is indented by fine letterpress printing. Only the music is plain. Just bare-bones melodies without ornaments or embellishments. Corelli expected his players to be amateur composers. They completed the music with their own decorative trills and turns. This was the age of the amateur, and it produced such creative genius. Modern professionalism was unknown. An amateur is literally someone who loves what he does, and that's what drove 18th-century genius, whether you played music or wrote mathematics. You were expected to put your own passions into your work. When Igor Stravinsky was asked how we should interpret his 20th century music, he said, "I don't want it interpreted. I just want it played." He wrote for the new breed of professional players that evolved in the 19th century. He wrote out all the dynamics and tempos. He asked no more than computer-like execution of his music by professional players and conductors alike. Professionalism was a 19th century invention. Individual players could still improvise in 18th century chamber orchestras, but that's quite impossible on the scale of a modern symphony. Science and engineering likewise turned into professions during the 1830s and 40s. They had to. The Brooklyn Bridge and the Space Shuttle both required coordinated efforts by a lot of dedicated professional engineers, by experts who would do things right every time. Yet the Space Shuttle is put in the sky by a rocket, and Goddard's invention of the high-altitude rocket in the 1920s was a one-man effort. Goddard was a highly trained professional, but he changed the world by thinking like an amateur. His rocket didn't reflect established expertise. It was a leap of the mind and a leap of the heart. Goddard had no guarantee of success, and he saw a lot of failure before his rockets flew. The professionals who watched him called him moon mad. The creative part of engineering is often done by professionals, but only in that moment when they lay expertise aside and behave like amateurs. Invention, by its nature, lies outside the professional's arsenal of established knowledge. You can spot the pros in a mixed group of professionals and amateurs. Their faces are blanked and detached. They limit contact with the amateurs because the amateur is potentially dangerous. He doesn't play by the rules. He risks error. He's the one who joins the game with his heart as well as his head. I'm John Leinhardt at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
You have been listening to the Weekly Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.